Iran's foreign minister says that talks on the revival of the 2015 deal are headed in a good direction.
We believe that if other parties continue the round of talks, which just started, with good faith, reaching a good agreement for all parties is possible.
The health condition of a Palestinian inmate in an Israeli jail deteriorates as he continues his hunger strike for more than 4 months. Germany's new government says it will stop selling weapons to countries directly involved in the war on Yemen, including Saudi Arabia. It's good to have you with us. Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are holding the second day of the eighth round of talks on the revival of the agreement. Iranian foreign minister says that negotiations are heading in the right direction and they can succeed in case the other side shows good faith.
The Vienna talks are headed in a good direction. We believe that if other parties continue the round of talks, which just started, with good faith, reaching a good agreement for all parties is possible. If they show seriousness, in addition to good faith, arriving at a deal soon and in the near future is conceivable.
Now, Tehran says the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions, as well as guarantees that Washington won't abandon the deal again, are at the heart of the ongoing discussions. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagherekani also says that the two sides do have an agreement in principle, but will now work on practical mechanisms to make that happen. He says the financial and banking sanctions against Iran will also be examined. Bagherekani says that all the participants have acknowledged the achievements made so far. In the last round, Tehran presented two proposals on the removal of the U.S. sanctions and Iran's commitments under the JCPOA. And meanwhile, Russia is striking an optimistic note in the Vienna talks, saying that indisputable progress is being observed there. In a tweet, the Russian envoy to the negotiations said that the working group on nuclear issues has held a useful meeting. Mikhail Olyanov says that sanctions removal is also being actively discussed in informal settings. China also believes that the talks have so far produced positive results. The Chinese envoy says that the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran is a key issue in the negotiations. He added that the biggest problem lies with Washington, as it was the party that quit the agreement. The U.S. abandoned the deal in 2018 and is not directly involved in the negotiations. Well, I talked to our correspondent in Vienna, and Hamal Izgi says that the eighth round of the negotiations there will continue until Thursday.
We know, of course, that the eighth round kicked off yesterday with the opening joint commission session, and the talks are continuing, are going to continue until Thursday, after which there will be a little hiatus, a little break from Friday through Sunday, when it will be the new year, and because Mr. Mora said there will be a lack of facilities or the Cobalt will be closed, etc., there will be a little break, but then on Monday again the sides will resume these consultations. And at the moment, the expert working groups, as well as the deputy foreign ministers, today have been continuing their discussions, focused both on the removal of sanctions, including the important issues for Iran that are verification and guarantees, and also a working group has been, we're hearing, discussing a nuclear issue. That means how Iran will go back to its nuclear commitment.
A Palestinian prisoner's condition is worsening progressively after being on a hunger strike for months. Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for more than 130 days to protest his detention without charge by Israel. The 40-year-old man has lost a lot of weight and is reportedly unable to move and speak normally. Israeli authorities have suspended his administrative detention order because of his critical condition. Abu Hawash is now in a civilian hospital, but his relatives are not allowed to visit him. He is one among several other hunger-striking Palestinians who are demanding an end to Israel's indefinite detention without charge. The practice is illegal under international law. Palestinians have held a rally in Gaza to protest Israel's inhumane treatment of female Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails. They also slammed the international community's failure to support the prisoners. Ashraf Shannon has the story.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons, and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The Arab League is a warning against Israel's new plans to expand settlements in the occupied Golan Heights, calling them null and void. The organization says that Israel must stop attempts to change the demographic makeup of the territory and its legal status. The Arab League also noted that the Golan Heights belong to Syria and any Israeli settlements there violate international law. The regime is planning to double the number of settlers in the Golan by building thousands of new units there. Local residents turned out to protest the plan over the weekend. The Syrian residents say that Tel Aviv is seeking to forcibly remove them to make room for its illegal settlements. The public analyst Saeed Chahavi says that Arab countries are unwilling to take any steps to force Israel out of the occupied Golan Heights, especially after normalization of ties between the regime and some Arab states.
Position with regard to the Golan Heights, which is being annexed by the Israelis, must be very clear. The stance of rejection by words only is not enough. There should be an Arab plan to force the Israelis to leave the Golan Heights, to hand them over completely to the Syrian government, as they did in the case of the Lebanese territory in the year 2000, and of course as they did with the Sinai that was returned to Egypt. So the Golan Heights, the East Jerusalem, they are all illegally occupied in 1967 aggression by the Israelis on the Arab countries, but the Arab countries unfortunately are not really willing to take a stand, especially after the normalization process that had taken place in the last 2 years, especially between the United Arab Emirates, the government of Bahrain, and the Israelis. So unless the status quo is changed by the Arab countries, the Israelis will find no incentive to give up its annexation of the Golan Heights.
Now, in other news, Germany weighing up imposing tighter controls over its arms exports. The new government says it will have stopped selling weapons to countries directly involved in a years-long war on Yemen that includes Saudi Arabia. The coalition government of Chancellor Olaf Scholz says that the plans include advocating for an EU arms control regulation and national law on arms exports controls. New official data shows the total value of approved arms exports by Germany rose to a new record this year, climbing past $10.25 billion. Germany, the U.S., the U.K., and France have been the main weapons suppliers to Saudi Arabia and its allies since they launched a war on Yemen in 2015. Human rights activists say that the weapons are used against civilians. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced. Now, 2021 was an eventful year for Europe. Apart from dealing with the pandemic and the socioeconomic challenges it caused, the continent grappled with other issues, including those related to its internal politics. The next report brings you some of the major developments in Europe in 2021.
Europe grappled with many issues during the year 2021. Developments happening in the aftermath of the UK's exit from the European Union a year earlier were among those issues. Britain remained at odds with the EU over post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland, while being involved in a dispute with Spain over Gibraltar. The UK was also at loggerheads with France over post-Brexit rights for their fishermen. The supply chain crisis was another issue that resulted in high commodity prices across Europe. Officials blamed the crisis on the pandemic, rising demands, and shortage of workers. But many industry leaders pointed the finger at politicians and their policies, including tax hikes. The pandemic also led to social unrest in Europe, where people in many countries were angry at restrictions, mandatory vaccines, and health passes. They accused their governments of mismanagement. In France, anger also boiled over police brutality, as well as President Emmanuel Macron's economic policies, blamed for existing inequality. Those policies brought yellow vest protesters to the streets after months-long pause over the COVID pandemic. The Belarus-European Union border crisis was another highlight. It all began in July after thousands of migrants flocked to Belarus's border with three EU member states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland. But they were pushed back, arrested, and even beaten by the three countries' border guards. Rights groups and activists slammed the EU for violating the rights of the migrants as they remained stranded in difficult conditions. Another migrant crisis also unfolded in November when dozens of migrants lost their lives after the boat capsized in the English Channel. They were using the waterway to reach Britain from France. The tragedy also fueled a dispute between Paris and London, each blaming the other for not doing enough to address the migrant issue. Also in 2021, the EU faced a rebellion from two of its member states, Poland and Hungary. The two, among other things, were opposed to an EU law that says the bloc's law trumps national decision-making in each member state. In November, the two countries vetoed the EU's long-term budget and coronavirus rescue plan. The EU, in response, blocked billions of dollars in economic aid. The EU was also at odds with Russia. Tensions increased to the highest level since the end of the Cold War over Ukraine. The bloc accused Moscow of planning an attack on its neighbor, a charge the Kremlin denied. Moscow in turn accused NATO of using Ukraine as a pretext to increase its military presence on Russian borders to encircle the country. In July, a joint media investigation uncovered a worldwide network of wiretaps targeting politicians, journalists, and activists. They were spied on with the help of the Pegasus spyware that was designated by the Israeli company NSO Group. Some of the victims include European Council President Charles Michel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and several of his cabinet ministers. The scandal sparked a crisis in Israeli-European ties, with France freezing diplomatic and intelligence cooperation with Tel Aviv. The EU also condemned the regime's spying. And on December 8th, Europe saw one of its long-serving leaders quit power. Angela Merkel stepped down as German Chancellor after 16 years in office, following elections held in September. Analysts say Merkel's departure is expected to change the course of Europe's biggest economy, and that her absence will leave a substantial leadership gap in the continent. All in all, 2021 was a tough year for Europe, as it faced many challenges on all fronts. European leaders seem to have a tough time ahead, as they should find solutions to these challenges to prevent further crises in their continent.
Moving on, hundreds of thousands more people in northern China will have to stay at home as authorities are tightening COVID restrictions. China has already imposed a strict lockdown on 13 million people in the city of Xi'an, that's the new hotspot. And now nearby cities are introducing similar curbs after detecting new cases. There have been more than 200 new cases in the past day. That's pretty low compared to infections in Europe and the U.S. China has a zero COVID strategy owing to tight border restrictions, quarantines, and lockdowns. Thousands of testing centers are now operating in Xi'an to help deal with the resurgence of the virus. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities and membership in any political party or group, due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulama and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the US, hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the US started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like The Deluge and the story of Joseph and Zuleika in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it?" But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too. The noble prophet demolished the Zarar Mosque. That we are opposed to cinema, it means we are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "Radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy, and for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists. They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued, every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters." Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, "Have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation?" Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa الله الله يا الله والله
Democracy of Religion from Imam Khomeini's Point of View, a short part of an article by Hujjatul Islam Muhammad Malikzadeh. In Imam Khomeini's viewpoint, there is no place for imposition of affairs on people against their wishes. Imam Khomeini states, "The Almighty and Exalted Allah has not given us the right. The people of Islam has not granted us the right to impose a thing on our own nation. Yes, it is possible that sometimes we make an appeal to them, a humble appeal, an appeal that the servant of a nation makes to a nation."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Spring of Truth. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi. Imam al-Khomeini was quoted saying in one of his speeches, "I do hope that these gatherings be arranged more often on a wider scale." Now, obviously, it's a fact that we cannot deny that these majalis that we hold for Imam al-Hussein or for Islamic teaching and preaching, they have an effect on people. They do change the minds of people. They do make people act and do better things and good things. It makes people do and refrain from committing haram and sins and what have you. We can't deny that fact. Sometimes these majalis are held on a smaller scale, you know, for a couple of people who decides to have, you know, a majlis in their house. Sometimes it is on just a masjid. Sometimes it's, you know, event, occasional events. And we have this on smaller scale. Imam Khomeini says, no, we need to educate the masses, not just small group. Why can't we teach the masses? Why does these gatherings have to be on a smaller scale?
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
Why can't we have majalis, for example, on a larger scale? Give you an example. Musicians, when they go on tour, they hold tours on a larger scales. For example, they do them in soccer stadiums, for example, sports stadiums, because they hold hundreds of thousands. And this is music where people just go there for an hour and do stupid things and come back home. Why can't we hold these majalis in the same manner on a larger scale? Have an entire area, for example, come out to a specific majlis or a specific gathering, or the entire country in this regard. Why can't we do that? The bigger we do it, the more awareness we will bring. Like you see in the Arba'in, the 40th procession of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when you see millions of people attending one specific event, people around the world will ask questions, what in the world is going on? Why are there 20 million, 20 plus million walking? What's happening? Did something happen? People will question. When people question, they get answers. These answers, it might change their perspective on life. It might change the way they are or their faith, and they become better people. They become Muslims. So Imam Khomeini says, let us hold these sessions, these majalis, these processions on a larger scale, so we can get people more aware. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day.
Every night and every day. Never. La ilaha illallah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and I am your host, Atta. And in this series of the program Viewpoints, produced by Brother Mahmoud, we are trying to cover an analysis on the most important speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Imam Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alevian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So, the first topic for today's discussion is some parts of the speeches of Supreme Leader of Iran and some of his opinions regarding the sacred defense of Iran or the holy defense of Iran. In Farsi language, we say Defa-e Muqaddas or Jang-e Tahmili, which means the holy defense of Iran or the imposed Iraqi war. We can say upon Iran or on Islamic Republic of Iran, which took for 8 years, and we missed so many of our commanders, of our youth. They have become shaheed in defending this land, this holy land of the Islamic Republic of Iran. First of all, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, I know that as a person who, we can say, is not an Iranian, but might have heard about the sacred defense of Iran and these imposed Iraqi war. What was the significance of this holy defense of the Iranians that many people from different nations across the world in the Muslim lands talk about it and talk about its significance and importance? What is it exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, I disagree with one of your statements that you said it was the opposed war by Iraq. It was an opposed war by America. Because Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, he said America is our enemy. That's and right. Israel. Okay. Obviously the Zionist regime. It wasn't Iraq. Mm-hmm. Yes, Saddam Hussein was a tool for them, which they later came and obviously they took his rulership and they also attacked on him. He was a tool.
That's right.
He wasn't the main enemy of the Iranian nation or the Islamic revolution. The main significance is that this revolution wasn't an Iranian revolution. It wasn't a national revolution, or the people who were talking about their just welfare or the material, you can say, needs or for this material world. It was a sacred and divine revolution.
That's right.
Which was an Islamic revolution. And Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, he raised his voice for the pure Islam, basically. Okay. Which was forgotten.
That's all right.
And it has a significance with the revolution that was raised by Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Obviously, okay. Imam Khomeini had this statement that whatever we have it from Karbala or from Imam Hussein alayhi salatu
wasalam. Just the samples and the lessons were taken from that.
So today, if we see that in the world, different people are talking about this revolution, this war, and they are talking in favor of Iran, okay. It's not in the favor of Iran, it's in the favor of Islamic revolution.
Okay.
Because they see this Islamic revolution as Islamic revolution, not Iranian or a specific revolution that is related to a specific nation.
You're absolutely right. From day one, America backed the powers outside in order to oppose this revolution, Enghilab and Iran. And as you said, Saddam's opposition towards Iran was also backed by U.S., but it was not only U.S., the European countries were over, even Soviet Union had role on that side, we can say, in supporting. And all the powers, I can say, the superpowers of the world were all against Iran, and a puppet like Saddam Hussein had role over there and the Ba'ath regime in order to oppose Iran. But, you know, we passed life and we experienced bombardments on that time. I could really remember I was a kid on that time. The fear that was among the people, but the bravery that was among the soldiers of Islam in the battlefields. Also the families were supporting the soldiers, you know. And we missed, unfortunately, so many of our, you know, youth commanders, intelligent commanders, who strategically were not learned to be a commander or a lieutenant, but as the rahbar said in his meeting regarding commemoration for Shahid Bagheri, he said that he was a young man who after 2 years has passed the life of an experienced 25-year general officer of the war. And these are some of the, I can say, miraculous aspects of the sacred defense of Iran, which took place on that time. But again, my main question, I know for you as a person who is not Iranian, as looks at the outside, authorial look at the sacred defense of Iran, this was a war against Batil, and we can
the
say
evil and the
yeah,
good.
Yeah, the truth. But let me get also to Brother Ali Alavian, who was an Iranian and passing life during those years. So, according to Sayyid Mohsen, this was haq and batil. What about you, Brother Ali? What do you think about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. Definitely, there was the war between haq and batil, the righthood and falsehood, and there is no doubt in it. Because, you know, Islamically speaking, in with an Islamic worldview, no Muslim is allowed to conquer the lands of other Muslim lands without, there is no right to start killing and beheading the brothers and sisters in faith and starting a war against another brother Muslim country. Look, both Iraq and Iran were Muslim countries, so there was no proof to start such a war. As Sayyid said, it was also a sort of pressure from the side of Western countries, namely America, to start and impose such a war. And it was because of the spread of the message of the Islam that was quite new in Iran, and it was about to be exported to other parts of the world. And alhamdulillah, up to now, it it found its place.
Okay.
So they were actually expecting such a days that we are in, that they were afraid of such a days that we are in now. Okay. So they wanted to prevent something like this to happen.
The Islamic Revolution was very much young at that time.
Exactly,
you know?
It was at the first years of the Islamic Revolution, yes. The second and third year of the Islamic Revolution.
Such a war against a revolution when it is young, when the roots, and we know that we had so many, problems inside,
okay,
different
true.
Clashes with these deviated groups at the beginning of the Inqilab, and then the Fai Muqaddas starts. So one of the things that Rahbar insisted on was the role that the youth had during, and we know that we maybe the average age of the soldiers and the commanders was between I can claim even 15 year old up to 25, okay?
Very true.
This is the average age. So how do you think that the role of the youth was important at that time?
Actually it was miraculous, as you mentioned even in your introduction. The youth that were involved in the defense, holy defense, actually were all young. And I don't want to say that necessarily all the youngsters were in the battlefield, but from different classes of the society,
yes,
people actually were involved and were helping and supporting the battle fronts. But the role of youth actually was really exceptional. And the youth, they had no experience of any war, because it was, as you said, it was quite young society, young government, young,
yes,
revolution, the first or second year, and we had nothing left from the previous regime.
Mm-hmm.
They never studied any military sciences anywhere.
Yes.
The martyr that you named, Martyr,
yes,
Bakri, actually,
yes,
he was working, I think, in municipality of Tabriz, if I'm not,
yes,
mistaken, for two
and
years.
So many
but
others, you know.
But later, when he went to battlefield, actually, he did something miraculous. I mean, he was the maps and the recognition of the battlefield,
yes,
of the enemy that he was drawing actually,
mm-hmm,
was something that even the experienced generals of, yes, Western countries could not do such a thing. And actually it was in a sort of way he was resolving different dilemmas and,
yes,
puzzles that were actually planned by Westerners in the battlefield.
Extraordinary things were done. Not only by Shahid Bagheri, but also Shahid Hemmat Bakeri, we can say Shahid Zainuddin, who was really famous, and all of them young, under
very
20,
true,
25, you know, years old on that time. And let's get to Sayyid Mohsen. So, Sayyid Mohsen, what made these youth different from the other youths? Because at the age of 20, maybe up to 20 years old, usually the youth are thinking about something else, you know, the bravery of being present in the battlefield, or thinking about the battlefield maps, drawing them, we can say drawing strategies for the battlefield. This is a very difficult task. What made them different? Its use is different from the others.
Well, obviously, this nation, it depends on the leader that you have,
mm-hmm,
in every nation, in,
yes,
every revolution. It depends who's your leader. For example, in the Battle of Karbala, we see that Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam is the leader of the Muslim army,
yes,
and there we see a 6 months old baby,
mm-hmm,
a 13 years old boy, Hazrat Qasim,
yes,
an 18 years old young son of Imam, and there are other sons of his, like brothers and cousins and the companions as well. And even we have seen like Habib ibn Wazair, who was 70 years old.
Yes.
Whenever your cause and goal, whenever it is high and it's sacred, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give the wisdom to all the members of the army,
mm-hmm,
no matter what age they are. For example, there is a famous story of that time that one of the kids, he wrote a letter to Imam Khomeini, and he asked him, he requested him to stop reading the, the morning story or the story of Hazrat Qasim,
mm-hmm,
of his martyrdom, because Hazrat Qasim was,
yes,
13 years old.
Yes.
And he said that whenever I go for, like, whenever I apply to go for the front line, they say me, you need to be at least 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And while in the pulpit,
yes,
you talk about Hazrat Qasim, he was 13 years,
mm-hmm,
old. So this basira,
mm-hmm,
we can say,
yes,
this, you can say,
enlightenment.
The enlightenment.
Yes, the foresight,
the foresight
insight that they had.
That
right.
They had,
okay,
obviously, This was in this nation,
yes.
And it was given by the leaders, obviously. Mm-hmm. The leader was clear about the goal, yes. And aim. And the best thing about this war was that we call it Difa'i Muqaddas.
Yes.
The Holy Defense.
Yes.
The Holy Defense war is not invading. You know, when you want to invade some place, mm. you need to gather army, you give them money and all those.
Yes,
but whenever
fine.
It's about the defense, you're basically defending your country, mm-hmm. your house.
Yes, that's right.
These people have this, you can say, this courage
mm-hmm.
to basically defend from their own country.
That's right.
Because if they were not defending this, mm-hmm. their family is going to be obviously killed by
that's
the
right.
enemies. So this was one of the main reasons that mm-hmm. we can say that, and that's why it is called the Difa'i Muqaddas. And as Brother Ali has mentioned, that in Islam, we don't have invading. Even in the
That's
history,
right.
we have, if we have some people like some rulers who invaded different countries,
mm-hmm.
that was the wrong thing which
That's
they
right.
did, because Quran says La ikraha fid din. There is no, you can say, force in the Islam.
This war, for sure, was very much different from World War One or Two. Okay,
yes, it
in
is.
Which the invasion was over there, and also Rahbar.
That was for power as well.
Yeah, the power and also had mastery over other countries. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alevian.
Thanks to you, bro.
For your presence in the program. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, thank you much.
You're
brother.
Welcome.
Dear audience, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you much too for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints and Analysis on the Thoughts and Opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, regarding the sacred defense of Iran or Difa'i Muqaddas. Please visit our website, parstoday.com/Iran Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, fi amanillah, God bless you all.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. Through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, they are guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, you can lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.